341.
Yeah, the man says murder.
Creeper guy murdered somebody again last night.
She's scared to death, like every other woman in town.
I presume you refer to creeper murder?
Chemicals might affect certain glands and nerves. And if they did, his features would never be normal again.
This is what you and Pip did to me.
Okay, are we rolling? Good. Forgotten Horrors Podcast, take one. Cue the appropriate music. No. I said the appropriate music. That's more like it. This is Mike Price welcoming you to the Forgotten Horrors Podcast, a blatant exploitation of our new series of Forgotten Horrors movie books. It is my pleasure now to introduce John Woolley, without whom none of this would be possible. And now, the acclaimed author of Soul Soup for the Chickens and others too humorous to mention, John Woolley.
And, of course, you know that those dulcet tones belong to my friend and collaborator, Michael H. Price. My name's John Woolley, and we're here with another episode of Forgotten Horrors, and this time, we've got a universal horror movie that's not a universal horror movie, but anybody who's watched it may have been a little perplexed by PRC, who was more known for George Zucco movies that were kind of a cut below this in terms of production values. We're talking about The Brood Man here. And this was a PRC picture, but if you look at the credits and look at the producer, look at, the writers and everybody else, you realize this is a Universal film, but yet it came out under the banner of what Don Miller, the film historian, called the runt of the litter when it came to Poverty Row Studios, and that was PRC, or Producers Releasing Corporation. And
yeah, there are theories as to whether those initials might have stood for anything else.
Do you want to get a hint about what it could have been?
I think the first two words are pretty rotten. I have too much respect for PRC to indulge in that. You just got to acknowledge that it's not a well-respected studio, except by those who do respect it, and I suspect their numbers are pretty damn near legion.
Well, and, you know, we've talked about one of our favorite films. I know it's in the top 10 of mine. I think it's one of yours, too. And that's How Do You Do, the big Christmas release, I think, from 1945 that PRC did with Burt Gordon, The Mad Russian, which we've talked about on this show. I love PRC. I love PRC. PRC, to me, it's more interesting, or more interesting than Monogram, to whom it's often compared, I think. Let's talk about why The Brute Man with Rondo Hatton, which is essentially a prequel to a film that came out a couple of years earlier, House of Horrors, why it ended up with PRC instead of Universal. And we have talked about this off mic. It's time to talk about it on mic, I think. Why don't you go ahead and start that?
Well, Universal was chronically embarrassed by its B pictures. That is, B as in budget, not as in some school marmish grading system.
Right.
The B stood for budget. Actually, the B was the initial of a low budget producer at Columbia, and send this to the B unit, and the B became a word in itself. The B picture. There were, of course, B pictures before the term was coined.
Right.
Every studio, even MGM, even the biggest studios, had started out as independents.
Right, right.
Before they got corporate pretensions. And Universal had nurtured highfalutin epic pretensions since the day of the founding family, the Limleys.
Mm-hmm.
Uncle Carl and all his and his all kin. His embedded offspring.
Yes.
And, I mean, you look up nepotism in the dictionary, and there's a picture of Uncle Carl Limley next to it. The studio realized, however, that it was the B pictures that were bringing in the money.
Right.
They weren't such a risk to make. They had budgetary ceilings in the tens of thousands of dollars, perhaps the low hundreds if things got a little extravagant. And they didn't cost huge sums of money to make, but they raked in huge sums of money because they had loyal audiences.
Right.
And that brings us back to what I mentioned earlier about PRC having a very large circle of admirers, despite critical disdain. And Universal would chronically announce to the trade press, the Hollywood Reporter, Variety, publications like that, no more bees.
Right.
and the trade in return would answer, yeah, right. There were by the 50s, you know, when Universal, well, no more bees for us. Finally, they settled on a unit that produced rather pretentious bee pictures, what my late partner George Turner would have called nervous A's.
Right, yes.
And such as the Incredible Shrinking Man, mm-hmm. Orson Welles' production of Touch of Evil, pictures of that nature. I think a picture we discussed in recent years on this program, Female on the Beach, was
yes.
one of those pretentious bee pictures.
A nervous A.
Mm-hmm. A nervous A, mm-hmm. Yeah. Universal knew where the bread was buttered. And of course, they kept on making them. Rondo Hatton, the star of The Brute Man, was a unique case. His period of stardom, or as a working actor, that is, in the industry dated from the early 30s. He was a reporter and publicist in Florida, where a picture called Hell Harbor by Henry King came to shoot I believe it was 1930.
1930's right, first, yes. Mm-hmm.
The first Hollywood movie produced entirely, the first Hollywood talking picture, that is, produced entirely on location. Amid severe hardships, including tropical storms. And Henry King notices Hatton there to basically take notes for a report on the production, and remarked at his rather extravagant facial features and long limbs, and said, you want to be in this movie? And, sure. So he gave him a role as a dance hall proprietor in Hell Harbor. Well, that pleased Hatton so much that he just took his deformed appearance to Hollywood and made a career of it.
Well, I have the program book from Hell Harbor, and there is a picture of Rondo in there. He looks a lot different than he does in The Brute Man, of course, because his
right.
acromegaly or acromegalia, I've seen it both ways, which is basically a pituitary gland malfunction, was not as severe, you know, in 1930 as it was in 1945 or 46, whenever The Brute Man was released.
Yeah, it's a deteriorating condition. It basically causes the body to squeeze itself to death.
Yes, yes.
He knew that his life expectancy was kind of any day now.
Mm-hmm.
And he made the most of the situation. Medicine had not come very far
right.
in the 30s.
Right.
There are treatments now, but what were his options? Well, he had been a championship athlete. He had been a soldier in World War I, where apparently a gas attack had triggered the condition. And you know, he was a working blue collar intellectual who had bigger career plans in mind than his increasingly ghastly appearance would allow him.
You know, it's funny you should mention that, because I when Kirby Grant was touring with the Carson and Barnes Circus, which, as it turned out, it was because he'd bought into it and was trying to help them get back on their feet. I visited with him. He was doing the Sky King thing at that time, even though Sky King had been off the air in its original form for quite some time. This would probably be 1968 or 1969. And he ended up, I mentioned to him, we were standing in line, you know, it was the usual circus thing where for an extra 50 cents you can do this and you can buy the photo. And we bought a photo, my friend and I. And I mentioned Rondo Hatton and Spider-Woman Strikes Back, and he just lit up. And started visiting, and we walked us down the midway, my friend and I from college, and was talking about working with Rondo Hatton. And I was very obsessed with Rondo Hatton at the time. I was like 20 years old in 69 and was just a huge Rondo Hatton fan. In those days, you couldn't all of a sudden call up movies. We had to depend on stills in monster magazines, and when the film showed up in rotation on Shock Theater, one of the other TV packages.
Yeah.
And he said that Rondo Hatton was a very literate man that would talk about literature when they were between shots on Spider-Woman Strikes Back, where he played the Creeper as well. And he was, you know, Hatton, of course, with the Rondo Awards, he's a fascinating character. But you mentioned that, of course, the Lemelees and then the ownership of the studio changed. And as you say, they would come up with announcements, no more bees, no more cereals. And at the same time, you know, you wonder if the fact that they were exploiting the disease that had, by the time the Brute Man came out, had killed Rondo Hatton, if they weren't a little squeamish about that, too, and that's another reason why they ended up selling the picture to PRC.
Definitely so. They had been exploiting Rondo since Pearl of Death, the Sherlock Holmes
feature.
Yes,
that's right. As the Hoxton Creeper, yes.
The Hoxton Creeper. Uh-huh. And he always cracks the third lumbar vertebra of his victim.
Right, right,
you
right.
Know? And then he did the character, I think it was called Moloch in Spider-Woman Strikes
That's
Back,
right,
another
yeah.
Holmes spinoff.
Mm-hmm.
And then the House of Horrors with Rondo stealing the show from the principal villain, Martin Koslick.
He certainly does.
Because Koslick's a hard guy to upstage.
Yes, he is. But Rondo
he was technically, Koslick was secondly, primarily a second string leading man in the villain category, but he always, you know, he stole the show away from Basil Rathbone in The Mad Doctor in 1940.
Yes.
Things like that. And so for a presence, not necessarily to say an actor, but a presence like Rondo Hatton to upstage the star of the show. Oh boy!
Yeah.
You know, and you sense there's something deeper going on. His line delivery was kind of flat. His body language was hulking, even though he wasn't that big a fellow.
Right.
And you sense there was some deeper current going on in this guy.
You really do. There was something there that we weren't seeing, and he was obviously. There's also the thing about. He was kind of being exploited. There was a certain sort of carny, you know, freak show aspect to exploiting someone's deformity, really.
Oh, yeah. Well, they, I think the embarrassment was patent on the part of Universal Pictures. And, of course, Rondo died amidships during this period.
Yes, yes.
Therefore, so here's the corporate mentality thinking, well, how are we going to sell some dead guy's motion picture? And on the other hand, a more benevolent approach. This is really not classy, guys.
Mm-hmm.
Let's offload this thing. So they gave to PRC, Universal Pictures gave to Producers Releasing Corp, what later would be called a negative pickup, where the smaller studio purchases the film and all its elements outright. And, of course, that includes the built-in Universal style, which was leagues above anything that PRC was turning out.
And I suspect maybe the Universal press book as well, because I've got the press book from Brute Man, and it really is very, a very well-done press book, although PRC did press books well, too. So
sure.
Right.
I mean, an exploitation company, of course.
Yeah.
Press book is the ultimate exploitation tool.
Well, we should say that it can be summed up, the Brute Man can be summed up very simply in that it's about a guy named who is called the Creeper because he starts murdering people. And the backstory is that he was a football hero, and the protagonist, the ever, well, just the pervasive Tom Neal, who was all over the place in B pictures at that time, and Jan Wiley, certainly a serial star, and was in what, like Secret Agent X9 and Master Key and Dick Tracy versus Crime Incorporated. She did a bunch of stuff. And then she married the songwriter Matt Green and apparently retired after that because Brute Man is her second to last film. The only thing that she did after that was a very, very small bit in Best Years of Our Lives. But so Tom Neal's character and the Jan Wiley character go by to, and Fred Kobe is playing the pre-creeper, a guy named Hal Moffat. And he's in chemistry lab because Tom Neal's character has given him the wrong answers in a chemistry quiz. And so he can't go out with Jan Wiley's character. And Fred Kobe's character, who is Hal Moffat, who's got a terrible temper, throws a beaker down, blows it up, and then he goes off somewhere. Nobody knows where he is. And he comes back and he becomes the Creeper and starts exacting revenge on those who were with him in college, who he felt done him wrong. And, you know, the interesting thing, one of the interesting things about this picture, it's very brief pictures, under 60 minutes, but one of the interesting things about the picture is that there are really no real protagonists in this. I mean, Donald McBride, as the police captain, is really the closest we have to protagonists. And everybody knows Donald McBride. He's a character actor, you know, that does an Edgar Kennedy slow burn in, like, you know, hundreds of motion pictures. And here, he really is our protagonist. Tom Neal isn't. You know, Jan Wiley isn't. It's very interesting in that way.
It's a very strange picture. The death of the actor, Rondo Hatton, amidships, as I said.
Right.
Basically, he died, what, in fall of 46?
Right.
Mm-hmm. No, I'm sorry, that was the release date.
He died in
the winter, early winter of 46.
40, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And
45, 46, right, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right, mm-hmm. yeah. I believe it was February.
Mm-hmm.
But the two follow-ups to Pearl of Death, featuring a modernized version of the Creeper, House of Horrors, and then the Brute Man. I think the Brute Man was an attempt to explain who is this guy, where did he come from, and to the amazement of a lot of people just discovering this picture, the screenplay incorporates a lot of a variation on Hatton's own story.
It does. It does. As well as some people have pointed out, to City Lights, perhaps, and also to Bride of Frankenstein, because in both of those cases you have a secondary character who can't see, and a main character, which Hatton's character, the Creeper, is the main character in The Brute Man, that forms a bond with the, mm-hmm. with that blind character. It's a pretty fascinating film, and you watch it, and it's got that great movement. You know, I don't know how much Dwight Babcock had to do with the final thing. I know he wrote the script, the story, but Dwight Babcock was one of those pulp guys that he was a black mask writer and a very good writer, and also he's the guy who created Hannah Van Doren, the gorgeous ghoul, who was in three books. She's a crime reporter for a newspaper, and the gorier the crime, the better she likes it, which in the 40s was kind of audacious. But Babcock, I believe that was Babcock's last film for Universal before he moved on. But you look at that, and it's such a competent film in so many ways. It does remind you a lot of those, very much of those later Universals when they were striving to get another horror icon going, no more than in the Jungle Captive, Jungle Woman,
films. Yeah, Captive Wild Woman.
And Captive Wild Woman. And which one of those had Hatton in it as well? Jungle Captive had Hatton in it.
Yeah.
But they were trying to establish that character of the Jungle Woman, and just the same way that they were establishing Hatton's character as a brute man. And it's a fascinating film in a lot of ways.
Well, it's a transitional picture. A lot of the Universal devotees dismiss it and the Spider Woman Strikes Back and the Captive Wild Woman pictures as bottom of the barrel franchise projects. But no, that it's basically one of the transitional pictures between the big Universal franchises, like the Wolfman, for example, which Universal continued to exploit as late as 1948,
right,
2 years after the Brute Man, and the later Universal, the big Universal franchise would have been the Creature from the Black Lagoon.
That's right. Yes. Yeah.
And so you even have an almost Rondo Hatton-esque Creature from the Black Lagoon in the third film, I think it is.
That's right. That's exactly right. I never thought of that before.
Where the creature is kind of vaguely humanized by plastic surgery.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure that was unintentional, but you got to take these little touchstones where you find
you
them.
You sure do. Well, we want to talk about the cast a little bit, and Jane Addams. I think everybody, the horror fans anyway, remember Jane Addams as the hunchback nurse in House of Dracula, which is one of my all-time favorite Universal pictures. Just wonderful picture. And San Antonio girl, old Harry Conover model, and studied at the Pasadena Playhouse, did her apprenticeship there for a couple of years. And I was looking up, I'd always heard that her nickname was Pony, but it was P-O-N-I, because she was a horsewoman. Well, I always thought that that was because of her love for horses. Well, come to find out, apparently it had nothing to do with that at all. It was just something that the Conover agency gave her because it would make her sound different. So she actually worked as a model as Pony Addams before she then went into the movies. And a great, you know, this film is made up of a great cast of just B actors. No one more typical of B pictures than Tom Neill.
Oh yeah, it's of that class of B player stardom. There aren't that many significant pictures that come out of the B picture, that come out of that realm, that treat their players as stars. RKO's picture Stranger on the Third Floor comes to mind, which, except for Peter Lorre, is like a real, like a star showcase for I hate to call them second stringers, but players that didn't stand a chance of getting top billing in a top of the line picture.
Right.
The Little Foxes, that is 20th Century Foxes B pictures, they do that to a tremendous extent, treating their B unit players as though they were glamorous stars,
like Lynn Barry, for instance, is a perfect
people
example.
People like Lynn Barry, picture like people like George McCready, who of course would graduate to a bigger status, but I think was most in his element in the B's at Fox.
Oh, I think you're right. And the Fox B's, of course, looked like A pictures for anybody else too.
Oh, you know, boy,
when,
yeah,
when you got that.
Yeah.
But you could always,
yeah, and you just wonder what Rondo Hatton might have done with a classier franchise like at Fox. You know, he would have made a great Michael Shane villain.
Yes, he would have. But you know, Universal was the one that had the back. You know, had everything set up with their horror franchises. So
yeah,
Wolfman,
yeah,
and you know,
they,
so you want a creeper.
And they knew how to market them. Yeah,
right.
Fox didn't know how to market horror movies, but they made their mystery. They made many of their mysteries into out-and-out horror pictures.
They did. They absolutely did. That's
strange
true.
Indeed. Yeah, nobody remembers Fox's superior werewolf film, The Undying Monster, because it's not a Universal.
Right.
But when people discover it and and another, well, say, a companion picture to The Undying Monster called Dr. Renault's Secret. It's a better human ape to human or vice versa picture than any of the Captive Wild Woman pictures.
Well, I think you could say the same thing maybe, although the studios weren't quite of the same status, but I think you could say the same thing about the Columbia pictures.
Oh, the
Columbia
yeah,
horror
yeah.
pictures. Which brings me to the fun fact for this for this podcast, Michael. Now, Fred Kobe's character, Hal Moffat, in college, has a girlfriend. She is played by a woman named Janelle Johnson. Didn't have a lot of credits, but she's got a pretty good part in Brute Man. She's in the opening scenes with the college, and she's in flashbacks. And I'm sorry, opening scenes and flashbacks to the college days. Well, she was Mickey Dolenz' mother.
Excellent.
She was married to George Dolenz, of course, who would talk about B players in Universal, who did a lot of B work at Universal. But she was Mickey Dolenz' mother. Now, stay with me here. So, Janelle Johnson and a fellow named Matt Willis, a character actor whom you know as the werewolf in the Columbia picture with Bela Lugosi, Return of the Vampire.
Return of the Vampire. Yeah.
Matt Willis was the werewolf. Well, Janelle Johnson and Matt Willis wrote a song called Pillow Time. I think it was written when Mickey Dolenz was quite young, because Dolenz was born in 45. And on the Monkees Present, or Present, I never know how to pronounce that.
Oh, the collection of basically solo.
The album, that's exactly right. By that time, they were kind of going solo. Mickey Dolenz, along with Shorty Rogers, Mickey Dolenz sings Pillow Time on the Monkees Present. And that's a song that was written by two horror B-picture stars.
With the Sandman at the throttle, you'll be off to dreams and pack. It's pillow time again. You will meet all your storybook friends as you go down Mother Goose Lane. Romp with Jack and Jill.
Which is a thing you cannot make up. And there's the Monkees doing Pillow Time by Janelle Johnson and Matt Willis. So there's something you can... Well, if you've got certain kinds of friends, you can amuse your friends with that. But you have to be very careful, I think.
Well,
but I just found that fascinating.
Well, Dolenz, of course, is a legacy player. And I don't think he's really been given his due.
I don't either. That's a whole that's a whole different thing. I don't think the Monkees have been given their due. I just recently read... Michael Nesmith's Infinite Tuesday autobiography. And, you know, they were in an untenable situation the way that they were. And you go back and listen to Nesmith compositions like Good, Clean, Fun, and listen to the band and all of those. And he's really doing some really good work. And he's an unheralded pioneer of that 70s country rock movement. And
well, he was. It's funny how so many architects of the Southern California sound, folk rock evolving into country rock, came out of Texas.
Yes.
Nesmith among them, and John David Souther, and you know the list goes on. But Well, that's the best digression we've come up with in years.
Well, it has. And Moon Martin, you recall, was with Southwind. There's an Oklahoma boy, too. And Southwind is one of those unheralded bands that helped start that whole early 70s. I mean, everybody talks about Gram Parsons. They talk about the Byrds. But there was a lot going on beyond that. And no one would take Michael Nesmith seriously because he was a monkey. I had the chance to visit with Michael Martin Murphy, who you probably know Michael as well. He's very, very nice guy. And we were talking about that. And, you know, you look at Michael's What Am I Doing Hanging Around composition he did, that the Monkees, that was all over the Monkees' first season, that's nothing but country rock. And he said, was the first, that was the sale that did it for him. That was the first big sale that he ever had. What am I doing hanging around? And so there you go. There is indeed a digression. But we were talking about the Brute Man. And I really think that it's unheralded in its way. It's underrated, even though, you know, the Rondo Hatton fans all know what it is. But it's a pretty good little picture.
Yeah, yeah. And it's... And it's a chronicle, kind of an inadvertent chronicle of a personal tragedy that got turned into a career.
Yes, and what happens at the end of that career, and then you end up on Poverty Row, and there you go. I would like to see at some point, and I haven't been able to find it, if Brute Man was a successful film for PRC, which I can't imagine it wouldn't have been.
I know it played long and well,
mm-hmm.
and it inspired a whole generation of kids who saw it on TV in the 50s.
That's right.
The first attempt I ever made at at making a horror movie was called Return of the Brute Man.
Nice, really. I had no idea.
I had the perfect stand-in and tallest kid in the neighborhood, and. We never finished it, of course. We
right.
left the footage undeveloped when, you know, okay, got to have rock and roll band practice. but you know, some frames survive, and I'm glad we did it. And
yeah, yeah.
My pal down the street was a real trooper to wear that ghastly Rondo Hatton
mm-hmm.
makeup,
mm-hmm.
which we made out of chilled axle grease.
Oh, my. Oh, my.
Yeah.
Oh, well, you know, and keep in mind, our friend Dave Stevens had a Rondo Hatton character in The Rocketeer, the comic book,
oh,
and
yeah.
then later on in the movies as
yeah,
well.
Later on in the movies, played by a really great stunt player known as Tiny Ron.
Yes, yes.
And much bigger than Rondo was, but Rondo played big.
Mm-hmm, he did. And, of course, you know, it's going to live forever with the Rondo Awards. Not that we're making a blatant attempt to try and get people to vote for us in the Rondo Awards, because it's over with now.
I think we're at this waxing, we're right on the point of the final close of voting. But
I believe that's right.
We'll
yeah.
be airing this after that. Well, you know, I never can tell. We've been bridesmaids in the Rondos for a long time.
We have.
It's always nice to get a nomination.
That's right. And I don't know when that's going to be happening, but we hope that if you like us, you vote for us, and you know maybe we'll have an effigy of Rondo sitting on our bookshelf at some point in the life of this program. Well, Michael, tell me what you got out on the market these days, and let's do a little bit of plugging before we say goodnight.
Oh well, I'm still plugging deep in the horrors of Texas, the anthology of Texo-centric. Horror comics, which of course you've got a big hand in,
right?
And working on the sequel when I'm not working on the new King Kong book and on our new Beach Party Pictures book and so on and so forth. But I've been sneaking some time lately to get back to that restoration of the Ghost Gallery comic book stories
yeah,
in the 1940s. And those are going along pretty good, and I'm taking the time, doing it right.
Good.
Well, I tell you what, restoring art from those beaten up old comic books is it takes diligence.
It's labor intensive, isn't it?
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah.
Well, I got to tell you, I've been obsessively watching the sales of the Forgotten Horrors 9, the latest in the series, and it seems to be doing quite well.
I'm amazed, always amazed, always pleased, always amazed. When the objective is just to get the books out,
mm-hmm.
it's nice to see them taken off.
It is, absolutely it is. Now, we want to also mention that we've got Bill Boyce, Money Actor, that's out there as a download. And Joey, our producer, has to always tell me where that is. It's on Amazon what, Prime?
Awesome.
On Amazon Prime Video, it just doesn't cost very much. You can't even get a sandwich. You can't get a bag of chips for what it would cost to see this. And also, we've been getting an order. We just got an order for a hard copy, which we've got also off of my website of Bill Boyce Money Actor. And let's see, what else have we got going? We have the Wes Craven book is still out there. I did that a few years ago, and it's I'm very surprised at how that continues to sell. And so just take a look at Michael Price or look at John Woolley on the on Amazon.com, and if you like something, please buy it. We could use the money. And I believe that's probably going to be it for this evening, except to say that we really appreciate your listening, first of all, and also that we would really recommend, I believe, Brute Man. It's very crisp. It's an hour of your life you can invest. If you love these old horror movies, you're going to come away with a good experience, I think.
Well, not to mention it's creepy as all get out.
It's very creepy. And the creeper is the creepiest of the bunch, and Jane Addams is great in it too. Well, Michael, we'll be reconvening again next month. Until then, it's always good to yak at you.
Yeah, you travel safely on the convention circuit, and I'll be back with you presently.
Very good. Thank you so much. Good night.
See you later.